And a cheery good morning to everybody.
Yeah. Top of the morning. Top of the morning.
I'm going to call to order this hearing of the Health and Human Services, or Health, gosh, I keep doing that because we are now Human Services too, really, but the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And we do have a quorum present, which I really am amazed and appreciative that we do, because people watching this later may not realize we were on the floor until, what, 5?
5:20.
5:20, but who's counting, right? A.M.
Bernie is.
And it is now 8:34, so.
Last time I stayed up that late, you don't want to know what I was doing.
Okay, so I think we're going to have a lot of fun this morning, but we really appreciate that. We have some folks who've come in to testify today, and some members who've come in who also were up all night, who are here to present some bills, and so we're really glad to have everybody here. So we're going to, let's see, do we have any minutes? No minutes this morning. Okay. And, okay. So first we will call up House File 2267, Representative Keeler. And the chair will move that House File 2267 be laid over for possible inclusion. And there's an A1 amendment. And did you need to move the amendment right away, Representative Keeler?
Yes, please.
Okay, so the chair will move the A1-1 amendment to put the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. All in favor of the adoption of the A1-1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And we adopted the amendment. Unanimously, it's a good start. Okay, and so to your bill as amended, Representative Keeler, welcome.
Thank you, Chair, members. Good morning. Sorry. So what House File 2267 does is it provides unique opportunities for urban Indian communities. We've talked a lot about the disparities that we see in our urban Indian communities, along with just disparities in indigenous populations in general. Often when we look at any sort of data or maps, it's our populations that are the worst. What we know is that close to 70% of Native Americans live off of the reservations, most of them finding themselves here in the Twin Cities area. So we do have an amazing health program that provides unique care to community members like myself. I grew up off the reservation. I utilized an urban Indian clinic my entire life. We talk a lot about representation and how that matters, and when we show up with doctors who look like us, who understand the culture and the connection, that's extremely important. Part of this bill is a grant program that actually was federal funded. It was federal funds that came to the state level that now is just needs to get over to the correct organization. That's what the amendment did, is in partnership with working with the agency. And it's also aligned with the Senate that passed this bill a couple days ago. I'm going to stop talking because I'm tired, I'm sure, like most of us. I'm going to pass over to our testifier.
Well, thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Patrick Rock. I'm a family physician at the Indian Health Board, CEO. Thank you, Chair Liebling, committee members. Thank you, Representative Keeler, DHS, Minnesota Tribes, and, of course, the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's Office and Support Staff for their support. Good morning. I am here asking for the committee's support for healthcare payment equity for the Indian Health Board, or IHB. IHB is a Title V program under the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act. We also consider ourselves an urban Indian health organization. My name is Patrick Rock, as I said. I'm the CEO of the Indian Health Board of Minneapolis. I've been a family physician there for 27 years. I could have easily gone back to my home reservation of Leech Lake in northern Minnesota after finishing my residency at Hennepin County Medical Center. But working in the Twin Cities opened my eyes to the unexpected and incredible health care needs of the American Indian community. Over 50 years ago, Indian Health Board became the first urban Indian health organization formed to receive grants from the Indian Health Service to address the health disparities of the urban community. But since that time, the native population has changed. Now 70% live in urban centers and 30% live on reservations. But the funding formula has not changed, with only 1% of the total IHS budget going to urban Indian health organizations. The U.S. national average health care spending is just under $10,000 per capita. In contrast, spending on tribal and IHS health care in greater Minnesota is funded at about 40% of that, roughly $4,000 per capita, while spending on urban American Indian health care is at an astonishing $600 per capita. That's only about 6% of the total U.S. average. This portrays both unmet treaty obligation and chronic underfunding that structurally perpetuates health disparities for the urban American Indian community in Minnesota. The proposed Medicaid State Plan Amendment, House File 2267, would address these issues of payment equity for Indian Health Board through two parts. Importantly, the Federal American Rescue Plan of 2021, or ARPA, allowed the state of Minnesota to accrue considerable budget savings due to enhanced federal match payments on the Indian Health Board and other Title V urban Indian organizations provided services over the last 2 years. These savings, intended by Congress to provide relief to the Indian Health Board for care to underserved populations during the pandemic, has still not been passed to the Indian Health Board. This grant appropriation would rectify this inequity for those served by the Indian Health Board. This bill also directs DHS to seek a state plan amendment to increase reimbursement for Indian Health Board closer to what the Indian Health Service and tribal services receive. This issue is based on treaty rights in that the financial responsibility of American Indian health care is with the government through treaties with tribal peoples. The differential reimbursement between the existing encounter rate for the Indian Health Board and the all-inclusive rate creates an unintended and automatic health disparity for those American Indians living in urban areas. The APM at the all-inclusive like rate would correct this, provide parity to American Indian peoples across Minnesota, irrespective of the location where care is provided in the Indian Health Service system, and support the reduction of health disparities for all settings due to higher reimbursement and investment in our culturally informed health services. Our ask on behalf of the Indian Health Board and our community, and as a physician, and a member of that community, is to support this bill. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Rock. Is there anyone else in the public who would like to testify on the bill? Okay. I don't think so. So let's go to member questions and comments. Representative Nadeau.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm a little slow this morning, so... When you explain, just do it slowly for me. Can you tell, and thank you, Representative Keeler, for bringing this, and it sounds like we're tapping into previously untapped funds that we got through ARPA, that the state got through ARPA that didn't go up to this FUHC. I'm not really familiar, so there's two things that I'd like you to explain. I'm not familiar with the Indian Council Board FQHC and how that works in accordance. Is it similar to like North Point, other FQHCs that I'm used to? That's my first question.
Okay. Dr. Rock?
Certainly. Thank you for the question. Yes, we are what they call a combined organization. So we get funding through HRSA, which makes us a FQHC. And we also get funding, or we're part of the Indian Health Service. So we have direct grant funding through the Indian Health Service. So we have a combined organization. There's only about 11 of the 41 across the United States that are duly recognized.
Representative Dendell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, and you also, the other thing that I'm not familiar with is I'm not familiar with the all-inclusive rate or the encounter payment rate, and that's where you said that there's a health disparity for your population. Can you explain those two ends and then how that disparity fits in there?
Certainly.
Dr. Rock?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Yes, the all-inclusive rate, so the probably the best place to start is considering how the Indian Health Service System is built. The Indian Health Service System is built on really three legs. We have what they call an ITU system. I stands for the IHS, T stands for a tribal, and the U is the urbans, which is us. Unfortunately, the all-inclusive rate applies for the I and the T. Doesn't apply for the U. So we, of course, have been historically had historically lower rates over the 50 years that we've been around. And it's always been within the system, this incongruity. But what has happened as when ARPA was passed, federal government increased the rate for the U part to match the entire I. But unfortunately, that differential, the amount that we historically received and what should have been received, we did not receive. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to raise the rate across so it's equitable across the entire system is what we're looking for.
And just to be clear, the dollars are not sitting in an account somewhere. They just came to the state and you just didn't get them as you were supposed to. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Nadeau?
Thank you. And this is my final one. So so when you talked in your testimony about there being a health disparity between the all-inclusive rate and the encounter payment rate, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful at all, it's really it's a money disparity. It's not really a health – I mean, I suppose it could end up in being a health disparity, but it's just the rates aren't balanced.
Dr. Rock?
Thank you for the question. So I think considering the disparity, so take for example, when COVID struck everybody, the rates unfortunately didn't translate into immediate resources that we could immediately tap into. So just take for example, we do get grants as organizations, as FQHCs get grants, but they're very restrictive in what you can and you cannot do with them. As revenue, we have probably the most flexible and reasonable flexibility to address immediate types of things that are necessary for the provisions of care for our community. So take, for example, we received grants through for COVID funding, and they were very restrictive as to what we were able to do with COVID funding. So we received funding through Indian Health Service to provide vaccination, et cetera. But we couldn't have and build structures for with those types of funds. That they were long-term types of they were perceived as long-term things. So essentially they said, well, all you can do basically is stand up a tent in your front yard and provide vaccinations for that, because a tent is removable, right? But with revenue, that we could make those immediate changes within our organization without waiting for the federal government or the state government to be reactive to the COVID needs of our community.
Yeah, excuse me one moment, because does anyone know what this sound is coming from?
Sounds like springtime.
I think it's Representative Carroll.
We're bringing spring here.
Okay. All right, yeah. Thank you. Okay.
Right through that.
I like that.
Smile. Oh,
that's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have thought I was hallucinating, but but I saw everybody else looking too, so. Okay. All right. Anyway, so where were we? I'm sorry. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you. And my final question, can you just, what is the average number of clients that you see and the size of the organization, just so I can put a box around this?
Sure. So we are, like I said, we've been around for 50 years, over 50 years now. We're actually the first urban Indian health organization in the United States. We see about an average of about 6,000 to 7,000 folks. And, of course, it changes now. especially with COVID hitting us. And we're actually seeing an uptick in our primary care. We offer dental clinic. We also have a behavioral health clinic. So we provide full spectrum care to our community.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. And Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Keeler. Thank you, Mr. Rock. It was nice you to bring spring there for a minute. That was nice. I just wanted to have you maybe, the numbers went by quick for me, and I was just wondering if you kind of go over the numbers. I heard the 600 per capita at the end, but maybe just give me a rundown of how those numbers, give me one more shot at it anyway.
Sure.
Dr. Rock.
Thank you for the question. So those are pretty common numbers. Like if you go to CMS, you can find those numbers pretty readily. And about the average healthcare costs for example, medical assistance, about $10,000 per capita for the United States. And then when you look at kind of the overall, and in contrast to urban Indian health specifically, we have about 70% of the population live in urban centers. And unfortunately, what that also signifies is that we have about 1% of the total IHS budget, so a multi-billion-dollar budget goes just strictly to urban Indian health. So there's a mismatch there as far as need is concerned. So that translates into about a $600 per capita per patient that we provide care to urban Indian health.
Representative Murphy.
And is that to the urban area or all the way across the board for everyone?
Dr. Rock.
That's a national figure. That's urban Indian health,
okay.
National.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Rock, for being here today. And just want to clarify, how many clinics are there across the state? Is it 11?
Dr. Rock?
No, there's 41 urban Indian health organizations across the nation, and there's one urban Indian health organization that receives IHS funding in the state of Minnesota. That's us.
One.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Rock, do you also have eye care clinic for optometry or something?
Dr. Rock.
We do not right now.
Do not. Thank you. And Madam Chair, one last question. I just was curious about, do you have a pharmacy in this location?
Dr. Rock.
We do not.
Do not. One last question.
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, is the one clinic or the one the one clinic, does it have access to the 340B program?
Dr. Rock.
It does, yes.
It does. Very good. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. And Dr. Rock, when from the point of view of the patient, when a patient walks in, do they have any out of pocket cost or any billing to them, or are they how does that work when somebody comes in off the street, whether they're an Indian person or somebody who isn't? How does that all work?
Yes, thank you for the question. We of course try to get folks enrolled onto some type of health care coverage. Of course, that's an access issue for us. We consider that an important access issue. If they have no insurance, we of course will see them no matter what. We do try to bill and recuperate those funds, but we're not really aggressive in our stance on trying to recuperate or provide reconciliation of that. So we have historically do send out bills, but we're not at all aggressive with it. We will see you again, and we'll ongoing. And so what's important to us is really relationship building with our community. You know, if we were seen as purely like a collection agency, we would not survive over the 50 years that we have. And so we find it very important to really contextualize it in putting money back into the organization, putting money back into the community is the way we see it.
Okay.
Any funds that we can recuperate.
All right, thank you. It sounds very similar to the FQHC model for the other FQHCs, right? Is that?
That's correct. We are an FQHC.
Yeah.
So we have to follow really the guidelines and the statute as far as FQHCs are concerned on billing and all those
requirements.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions from members or comments? All right. Closing comments, Representative Keeler.
Thank you. Thank you for creating the time for us to have this conversation and asking really good questions. One thing I've learned in my time here is that we have the opportunity to educate, too, about some of the uniquenesses that we have in the indigenous community, and this is absolutely one of them. So thank you all, and thank you for the continued consideration as we lay this over. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you both. And with that, House File 2267, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. Okay. We will take up House File 1436. And Representative Bang is here. And so I will move House File 1436 to be laid over, the first engrossment to be laid over for possible inclusion. I don't think we have an amendment today. So welcome, Representative Bang, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1436 is a mental health workforce bill. There's a couple of things I want to highlight. What it does, the first thing is it creates a pediatric primary care mental health training.
And Representative Bang, I'm having a little trouble hearing you, which might be just fatigue speaking, but the mics are really bad in this room, so you got to talk real close.
Can you hear me better now?
Yes, okay. Thanks.
I'll speak more directly into it. So the first part of the bill that I want to highlight is the pediatric primary care mental health training, which is grants to provide training for pediatrics to pediatricians who focus on primary care. Another program that it also establishes is the Mental Health Cultural Community Continuing Education Program. Actually, it's not established. It's already established. It's a loan forgiveness program for mental health professionals. And then another program that it establishes is the Mental Health and Substance Use Disorder Education Center. And this is to really to intended to increase the number of professionals and practitioners and peers working in mental health and substance use disorder. It also looks at increasing the Mental Health Professional Scholarship Grant Program. That's in Department of Human Services. And then it also creates a youth care professional training program. Other provisions it has is expanding eligibility for the professional education loan forgiveness and amends the primary care residency expansion grant to support 5 psychiatric residents. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll just keep my remarks short. This is a good bill, and I will yield my time to my testifier who can do a better job at explaining the significance of this bill.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Representative Bang. And we can probably all say that today because probably other people got a night's sleep and we didn't, right? So, Ms. Abderholden, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota and Co-Chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network. As you all know, the workforce shortage has worsened, and at the same time, our mental health system is in crisis. We do know that there are almost 3,000 people who graduated from graduate programs who did not go on to become licensed. We also know that in addition to the shortage, we also lack in diversity. 88.6% of our mental health professionals are white, and only 2.6 are African or African American, 2.8 Asian, 1.4 Latinx, and less than 1% are Native American. And so we know that some of the issues related to this are the difficulties paying for graduate school, also taking national tests that may not be culturally informed, having to pay for supervision or not actually being able to find a supervisor from your culture, and low pay compared to other types of health professionals. This bill actually builds on the successes of the last two sessions, thanks to your support and Representative Bang's leadership. I want to highlight just a couple of the pieces of the bill. One is that we recognize that mental health professionals are required to obtain about 4,000 supervised hours. We want to make sure that during that time that they're working towards licensure, that they would qualify for the loan forgiveness program. Adding another psychiatry residency slot is also important because we have such a shortage of psychiatrists. We were going to have a testifier who was here last night to talk about the pediatric clinic and that approach. And I think what we know is that we have such a shortage of child psychiatrists, and we've known this actually was in President Eisenhower's report. So we've known this a long time, and it's not working. So we need to make sure that pediatricians really learn about how to care for children who are experiencing depression or anxiety to really expand our ability to meet children's needs. We also want to continue funding the program that pays for the education necessary for a BIPOC mental health professional to become a supervisor. That was one of the barriers we heard. And I want to say I'm really excited because the program was passed in 2021. We saw 215 BIPOC mental health professionals become supervisors, which means they'll be able to provide supervision to about 400 students. So we think this was really successful, and we want to continue it. The other thing we know is that, again, sometimes you have to pay for supervision and do it for free. And we also know that clinics that take a high percentage of Medicaid patients have a harder time paying good salaries, right, to recruit people. So the program that you passed actually sends the money to those clinics to provide supervision for free, which helps actually recruit more people to work for them. And so it's a win-win, I think. The other idea is creating this mental health and substance use disorder education center within the health department. So we have someone truly focused on our workforce. They can analyze data, engage mental health or high school students, identify barriers to licensure, help people understand how this all works. We actually base it on a model in Nebraska. And we looked at what they did, and they had passed theirs in 2017. And in 10 years, they saw the number of providers increase 39%. So we thought that was a pretty good outcome. There's also a section in there for training for people who work with youth. We know that hiring and retaining staff is probably the most critical element needed to rebuild capacity and help children and families with the highest needs. And then lastly, we want to increase the funding for the loan forgiveness program. We do think it has worked very well. And so again, building on things that work, we would suggest that more money be put there. So I want to thank you for your time and attention this morning, knowing how tired you are, and really appreciate your attention to this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. I also have, your other testifier from Wilder isn't here, is that? Oh, she is here. Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, it's the physician who wasn't able to come.
Oh, okay. Very good. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Chair Liebling and the committee members. My name is Pahua Yang, and I am a psychologist and a clinical social worker by training. Currently, I serve as the Vice President of Community Mental Health and Wellness at the Wilder Foundation. I am here to testify in support of Representative Vane's House File 1436. The Wilder Foundation is a community mental health and substance use disorders treatment provider, and we are also a certified community behavioral health clinic, which means we are a safety net clinic for thousands of families in the Twin Cities each year. Part of our work has focused on being reflective and responsive to the individuals, families, and communities that we serve. And it's also our strong belief at Wilder that our providers and our leadership must reflect the people and communities we serve, and that how we show up as a service provider and in our communities, as well as how we show up as an employer, are equally important to helping move the needle for the people in our community. This is not just about doing the right thing as a provider, but it's also a good business decision. I want to tell you a little bit about my team, the therapists, social workers, psychologists, nurses, medical records people, compliance people, my front desk team, our interpreters and case managers and cultural brokers, all of my managers and directors. They have some of the hardest jobs because I ask them to do what our community needs and to do it in very challenging conditions and often with very little resources. And I know and they know that they can make so much more money in another industry or doing something else. And yet they come back day after day because they believe in what we do. They believe that the people, all of the people in our community, deserve good care and treatment. And they believe that we can make the system better because Minnesotans deserve better. My team is pretty special, and they are not unique. Every day in safety net community mental health centers across Minnesota, We have amazing providers who make the same commitment to our communities. And I am here to ask you to help make it affordable for them to be able to stay in these roles. It is no longer good enough just to expect people to do this work because it's good for the heart. In this workforce crisis across the country in an industry that can often be challenging and under-resourced, we are struggling to keep good people in the field, and we need to continue to make investments. So supervising staff and trainees under current state requirements come at a considerable cost to organizations and to trainees themselves. We lose valuable billable time and appointments when we pull clinicians off the schedule in order to train and supervise trainees. Clinics are on the hook to make sure that we cover these costs so that we can keep our services available while we also focus on training the next generation of providers. It almost sounds unconscionable to say this, but we need our good providers to be able to afford to stay in the field. I especially think about some of our providers who are raising families in parallel with their career paths. Part of our staff being able to afford to stay in the field means we need to be able to offer sustainable and competitive salaries, but we also need to be able to offer a way for our team members to repay high student loans. Adding supervision to loan forgiveness will help. Over 20 years ago, we began talking about the workforce shortage we were going to start to face in the mental health and SUD field. There's absolutely no doubt that we are firmly there now. I want to also add my applaud to many of you in this room who have invested heavily in workforce the last 2 years, because we are starting to see the needle move, as you heard from Ms. Afterholden. And actually, when I think about the many new clinical supervisors and trainees that we have licensed and trained because of your investment, I get teary-eyed, because they are the future of this work. And we need to ensure that this work continues to live and is sustained beyond any of us in this room. Investing in an education center dedicated to growing and supporting our mental health and SUD workforce will add to this long-term sustainability. And my hope is that in another 20 years, the conversation is about all the deep and creative innovations that our workforce is developing, and not about the things that we failed to solve now. So thank you so much for your consideration and for all your investment.
All right, thank you for your testimony. I think that's all I have on the list. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. Members, any questions or comments? Representative Ndell?
I hate I was going first.
Somebody has to.
That's what I figured. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Vang. I'm going to go kind of section by section, starting. I have a number of questions. I'm going to start with Section 8. This is the Mental Health and Substance Use Disorder Education Center that's going to be in the Department of Health. Is there an appropriation in this bill for that establishment, or is that, are the costs for that going to be covered in the agency's budget?
Representative Vang.
I believe, Madam Chair, we're still waiting on a fiscal note.
Okay. Mr. Harney, is there anything you can tell us about that?
Madam Chair, what's the question?
About Section 8, whether there's any kind of fiscal note on this, the Mental Health and Substance Use Disorder Education Center that's in the bill.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would have to anticipate the results of a fiscal note, and I can't do that.
Okay, so we don't have one yet, in other words. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Representative Nadal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then going over to Section 10 of that, Section 10. When we're talking about allowable uses for grant funds, it's mental health provider can use the grant funds received under the section. It's subdivision 4, number 1. The amount is up to $7,500 per student, intern, or clinical trainee. And I'm wondering, over what term? Is that annually, Is that until the intern or student becomes licensed? What's the term of that spending?
Representative Bain?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe, Sue, are you able to answer that question? And I think it's annually.
Annually?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Representative Nadeau.
And then my final question is the four of these where we're going to award grants to these clinics. These are licensed clinics like Washburn or Choice, whatever. Are these going to be master's level students who are not yet licensed? They're just working to get those 2,000 hours under supervision. Is that that population that we're talking about?
Madam Chair.
Representative Bang.
So it includes those. There's also trainees who finish, I believe, their schooling, and they just need that supervision hours to get the licensing, I believe. And Sue, you can correct me.
Senator Holden.
Madam Chair, Representative, so there's two programs. So there's one that will help people once they finish their graduate school education to get through those 4,000 hours of supervision so that the supervision hours could be provided for free instead of them paying for it. And then the other one is kind of grow your own, so people who are working in the field but aren't at the master's level to help them get there and then move on to become licensed.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you. This is super important, that we kind of do all we can. I know that, there's just not a lot of students that are coming in, and these clinics and organizations are doing everything in their power to attract people. I hope this helps. I think it probably may. I would love to see, an evaluation, a report that comes back. And maybe it's in here, and I apologize if I missed it. But I would love to see whether or not this has been an effective use of – I know it's going to be helpful. But I would really be good to see a linear how many people did we attract outside of, what we were going to normally attract. I mean, these organizations are working crazy to get people. I would really like to see a report come back to the legislature and say, this was an awesome use of public dollars to do this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any response to that? Ms. Apterholden, did you want to say anything about that?
Madam Chair, Representative, we were able to see with the program to help BIPOC mental health professionals become supervisors, we were able to track that and see that we actually used up all the money because people really saw that as beneficial. People were creative. They even created weekend programs. So because knowing that people are, already working full-time jobs, that trying to add some of those classes would be hard. So people actually created weekend programs. But I absolutely agree with you. It's important that we measure the success of these programs or where we can do better.
Okay. Representative Backert.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I see in the bill that this grant program has a requirement, correct me if I'm wrong, a certain percentage of the grant program has to serve the public need on the public programs. When it comes to mental health, are other grant programs set up the same way that it has to serve X amount of percentage? Instead, to me, that's not necessarily a need-based grant program. It's more program-based than need instead of focusing on the need. If you could comment on that, that just seems – I want clarification on that, please.
Representative,
I don't know if the author can or our testifier can help with that, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Representative Backer. Yeah. Representative Vang, do you want to
Thank
try
you,
that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think all the grant programs listed in this bill do require some sort of I think 25% have to serve the public or like Medicaid. Those in Medicaid, and so I guess that answers your questions. If you're talking about the overall programs at DHS or at NDH, I believe the department can better answer that question, and perhaps I can defer that to Sue, too, as well.
Okay. Ms. Apterholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Backer. So what we know is that Medicaid is the largest payer of mental health services, basically, and so when we look around the state, we find that particularly our community mental health centers in rural Minnesota have a very high Medicaid rate, and then some of the very urban programs as well. So we want to make sure that we're targeting these dollars towards those clinics, because we already know they actually make less money, right, if you're not having as many commercial clients. And so they're more on the edge, if you will, and often can't pay higher salaries as some of the private clinics are. So we wanted to make sure we were targeting those clinics to help them, frankly, be more viable and attract people, just understanding that they're receiving less money for the care that they provide.
No further. No follow-up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Doe.
Can I just follow up on that?
Yep.
And can you explain that a little bit further? So I do school-based mental health grants for the county, and by far the biggest payer is commercial pay, by far, like 70%, 60%, and then PMAP, MA, and then there's a small percentage. So is that not typical statewide? When you said that the biggest payer was MA, that just surprised me. Can you just clarify that a little bit?
Ms. Apterholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. It's going to differ a little between children and adults. But when we talk about adults, it's largely Medicaid that's paying for that. And for children, we have a high percentage of children who are on Medicaid in our state, but it's also going to depend on which districts, you know, which programs, things like that. The nice thing about school-based is it is graded funding, right? We're wanting to collect, you know, both commercial Medicaid, Minnesota Care, and then using grants, of course, for kids who are uninsured or underinsured. But that is going to vary depending on where you are in the state.
Okay. All right. Any other comments or questions? Representative Bonner.
I will be brief. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Vang and Ms. Apterholden. You know, the one fortunate part about being around these halls for a little while is seeing some of the programs that we have sponsored start to flourish. And I can tell you, it's not often that we get good updates on how some of those programs are performing and some of the fruits of those labors. And so I really appreciate the fact that we are starting to make a dent in diversifying the workforce. That's a huge deal. It really is. And so it's really refreshing to hear that. And I also appreciate some of the questions here about making sure that we're doing more for some of those facilities who may struggle a little bit to attract, retain, and serve folks in communities that may have a little bit more challenges. So I really appreciate that. So just wanted to express a gratitude.
All right, thank you. Anyone else? All right, not seeing anyone. So thank you so much for bringing the bill today. So House File 1436 is laid over for possible inclusion. Okay. And next we're going to have House File 2505, Representative Lee. And I will move House File 2505 to be laid over for possible inclusion. And there is an A1 amendment that, did you want to move that right now, Representative Lee?
Yes, Chair.
All right, so I will move the A1 amendment. We can adopt that. All in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted, and two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Legally members. I'm honored to present before you today House File 2505 with Bukola Oriola, who is a survivor of labor trafficking and also now an advocate for folks who find themselves in the same position she was once in. House File 2505 invests $1 million over the next biennium in a competitive grant process run by the Department of Health. These grants will go to community organizations that provide services in one or more of three buckets to help survivors of labor trafficking in legal services, emergency housing, or case management. The impact of this funding will have an outsized impact because it is a space that has not received state funding previously. This critical funding will ensure continuity of the work that the department does in partnership with nonprofits throughout the state that are already doing good work in the space. And with that, I'd like to turn over to my testifiers in the interest of time.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please just state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, ma'am. Good morning. My name is Bukola Oriola. I'm from the Anything Story. Good morning, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Bukola Oriola, executive director of the Anytown Story, a survivor-led nonprofit organization with a mission to advocate for victims and empower survivors of human trafficking and domestic violence in Fridley. I also served on the U.S. Advisory Council on Human Trafficking for two consecutive terms under President Obama and President Trump's administrations. I would like to express my profound gratitude to Representative Liz Lee for championing this cause as the chief author, as well as Representative Kaoli Van Ha, Representative Dave Pinto, Representative Maria Issa Perez Vega, and Representative Samakap Hussein for co-authoring the bill to provide funding for comprehensive trauma-informed and culturally specific services to victims of labor trafficking or labor exploitation. In addition, I would like to thank the committee members for all your hard work on eliminating human trafficking in Minnesota, especially your work on sex trafficking and sexual exploitation. I'm testifying today to highlight the issue of labor trafficking. Labor trafficking happens to both youth and adult Minnesotans, but there are not enough services available to them even when they are identified. The legislature made an important first step in 2019 in recognizing labor exploitation when it passed the Wage Theft Protection Act, which has led to identification of some labor trafficking victims. It will be very helpful to our state at large for the legislature to provide funding for more services to victims and survivors of labor trafficking to help them when they are identified. The Anytown Story was founded as a result of my own personal experience as a victim of labor trafficking in Anoka County. I was enslaved for 2 years, working while someone else was taking my pay. I was in my 20s with a newborn when I suffered emotional, physical, and psychological abuse in the hands of my trafficker. Due to time constraint, I would just briefly ask you to take a moment to close your eyes. Imagine a 7 months pregnant woman brought into the hospital by the ambulance in a white chiffon robe as her only covering. Upon checking on the distressed woman, the woman was released to go back a few hours after. That was a first opportunity for one of the professionals who is likely to come in contact with a victim of labor trafficking intercept the situation, but that opportunity was missed. Also, imagine a woman later in labor and delivery, bleeding profusely after dilating to 7 centimeters, while the baby's heart rate was going down and there was no medical explanation for what was going on. An emergency C-section was carried out to save mother and baby, as if that was not enough. But for those of you who are mothers in the room today, can you imagine giving birth and not wanting to go home after delivery? Because I didn't want to go home. Yet, that was my experience. And another missed opportunity to identify and connect a victim of labor trafficking to help. Having more services in place will help hospitals to identify this harm and have a way to connect survivors with help in the community. When we talk about labor trafficking, we think about lack of wages or dangerous working conditions. However, it is more than that. As victims experience trauma they may live with for the rest of their lives, because I am still living with my own trauma. More so, there may be individuals who may be affected and their lives in danger, directly or indirectly. Like my son, who I'm grateful for to God that he made it. This was my son a few hours after he was given birth to struggling for his life at neonatal.
That's
all right. Take what time you need.
I'm grateful that he made it, despite the fact that he was struggling for his life at birth and had to be taken to neonatal to save him as a result of the trauma he endured due to my suffering as a victim of labor trafficking. Today, Samuel is in the room with me. He chose to come with me, even though there is school today, and I had to cut the school this morning that is coming here with me, and he will come to school afterwards. He is here to ask for your support to fund HF.505 bill for comprehensive trauma-informed and culturally specific services to victims of labor trafficking or labor exploitation. In fact, he recently wrote an essay in his honors English class on labor trafficking and why it should be funded. He has also submitted a letter to Chair Liebling. In 2018, the Eniton Story received federal funds through a United States Department of Justice Office of Victims of Crime grant administered by the Minnesota Department of Health to provide direct services to youth experiencing labor trafficking. During the implementation of the three-year grant, we reached over 10,000 Minnesotans through outreach and provided over 100 training to service providers and government agencies at the local and state levels. However, we realized that many trainees were coming across victims of labor trafficking but did not know what to look for. Worse still, when victims are identified, there is little to no resources available for them due to lack of state funding. Continued federal funding is not guaranteed, and it is not a large amount. Minnesota has done a great job at recognizing sex trafficking and sexual exploitation through its Safe Harbor Network. And now, we want to do the same for labor trafficking or labor exploitation. Thank you again in anticipation of your support of this bill, and I'm willing to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. There's another testifier on the bill, I believe. Welcome to the committee. If you'd please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of House File 2505. My name is Madeline Lohman, and I'm an Associate Program Director at the Advocates for Human Rights. This bill addresses possibly the biggest gap in our effort to combat labor trafficking as a state and is crucially important to ensuring safety for victims and accountability for traffickers. Currently, there are no dedicated state-funded services for labor trafficking victims. My organization provides immigration legal services to trafficking victims, and we see this lack of services impact our clients again and again. Please review our written testimony for more detail, but in the interest of time, I will share just one of the stories. We worked with a child labor trafficking victim who had managed to leave their trafficker and was waiting for federal immigration status, but ended up being trafficked again into a dangerous job in the construction industry because he could not access any supports while his status was pending. We are not the only ones to see the negative impact of the lack of dedicated services for labor trafficking victims. I have spent the past 2 years working with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to develop a protocol for law enforcement agencies to improve their identification and response to labor trafficking. This is the issue that law enforcement officers raised again and again. Who could they call when they encountered a victim that would understand the situation, help the victim feel comfortable with law enforcement, and provide the victim a safe, stable place to stay while the case progressed? We had no good answer to that concern. I have also trained service providers, community organizations, medical providers, and other organizations around the state to identify labor trafficking. And again, the question I hear after every training is, who can I call? And there is never a satisfactory answer. We provide dedicated services to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and sex trafficking. Labor trafficking inflicts similar trauma and harm on victims, and we leave them with nothing. On behalf of everyone that we work with to combat labor trafficking, survivors, law enforcement, service providers, community partners, we ask you to support this bill and ensure that labor trafficking victims in Minnesota receive care, support, and safety. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? Okay. Member questions. Representative Backer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a few. My first question is when it comes to labor trafficking, and what services, once you rescue them and help them out, what are generally the services that you focus on? If you could help, you know, I know I suspect everybody's different. I get that. Not everybody's are the same. But there are probably, I'm assuming, housing, food, training. But if you could elaborate on what services you've been able to provide to help, like our first testifier.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, and we got to go through the chair. And would you state your name for me again?
Yeah, it's Madeline Lohman.
Madeline. Okay. Thank you. Please go ahead.
So my organization provides immigration legal services. So trafficking victims who are foreign nationals can apply for a T visa, which allows them to stay in the country to participate in the criminal prosecution against their trafficker, and then they can eventually turn that into permanent residency. So we help them access that. And as part of that, we attempt to connect them with service providers. The biggest need that we see is housing. They need a safe place to stay that their trafficker cannot access. They generally need it immediately on an emergency basis because the trafficker very frequently controls their housing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have seen traffickers recruit people out of homeless shelters. Trafficking victims do not feel safe in homeless shelters, so they need something that's more secure. But often they are a labor trafficking victim is not a victim of domestic violence. They're not a victim of sexual assault. They may not be eligible to go into those safe shelters. So that's one area of service. The other is that trafficking inflicts serious psychological harm on victims. They've been controlled and manipulated by their trafficker in a way that is very similar to domestic violence. And that means that they have pretty significant needs for counseling and for case management, that they may struggle with making decisions. They may struggle with feeling at fault for what had happened, or feeling that the one person they trusted has abused that trust. And all of that is a pretty significant trauma. In addition to any physical harm that they may have experienced, some of the trafficking cases here in Minnesota that have been prosecuted involved starving the victim, beating them, allowing them to be injured on a job site and then not allowed to seek medical care, sexual assault, and other abuses. So they're facing pretty significant physical and mental trauma as well and need counseling and assistance there. So those are some of the big ones that we look for.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, one more question. Thank you, Madam Chair. And this, I don't know if this is a department or maybe the testifier or the author can help. Labor trafficking efforts is distributed to between MDH and Department of Safety. I mean, how does that work? Like with this grant program, you know, obviously each department, because of who the clients that they serve, won't come down the same traffic, the person that's being trafficked. Public safety may see something through law enforcement. Department of Health may see someone that's reported at a hospital or something like that. So help me understand how that is currently distributed and so forth. Because obviously that's how you find out about these individuals who are being trafficked, unfortunately. So this grant gets to the right folks. So if you could help with that. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's my last question.
Okay. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I'm going to give it to Caroline from the department who can probably answer that question much better than me.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you would please state your name and who you're with.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Caroline Palmer, and I'm the Safe Harbor Director at the Minnesota Department of Health.
Okay.
And Representative, that's a great question. I think what has been so special about our human trafficking response in our state is it goes across many different agencies and we collaborate with each other. So in the Minnesota Department of Health, we look at supportive services. We look at regional navigators who sort of work with all of the areas of the state to get people to services. We train, we do technical assistance, and we evaluate how our programs work. We partner extensively with the Department of Public Safety, specifically the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which has an investigators task force on human trafficking. We also partner with their training unit in the Office of Justice Programs. And then finally, we partner with the Department of Human Services, which has the Office of Economic Opportunity, which does all the housing work and outreach work, and also their child welfare and vulnerable adult response. So we truly have a multidisciplinary response in our state.
Okay. Representative Backer?
No further questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bonner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I wanted to start with just saying thank you to Ms. Oriola and Samuel for being here today. I just want to say that you are bold and you are beautiful. It is so hard to be here in this space and have the courage to tell your story. And there is no greater gift you can give your son than to see your strength and your resilience. And so thank you for being here today. I'm sorry, unfortunately this story is not uncommon. In the last couple of years, I've been working on a number of provisions, particularly around domestic violence. But one of the bills I had started working on was helping to replace identification for victims of domestic violence, particularly because one of the ways in which we control our victims is we take away their identification. So they can't leave, they can't get a job, they can't get an apartment. They are effectively a prisoner in this country with nowhere to go and no one to talk to. And in the process of that, what I heard fairly loudly from folks at MnCASA, from the human rights divisions, and so forth, is they asked me if we could extend that to include labor or trafficking victims as well, who have many similarities in that and sometimes fewer resources. And so I really do understand the need for this and why it is not being covered. It is a gap, to be sure. And so I am grateful that, Representative Lee, that you are taking up this challenge, that we have folks here in this room. It is so heart-wrenching to hear some of the stories, and in some cases, we are seeing increases in the prevalence of these crimes. Some of that I have heard explained as being a border state. It's easier to traffic people in and out of our state. Some of that is just this horrible, horrible sense of abusing human beings. And it is heinous and reprehensible. And I really appreciate that we are here today having a conversation about how to fill those gaps and how to make sure that more strong and resilient and beautiful people can survive it. So thank you for that work.
All right, thank you very much, Representative Bonner. Any other questions or comments? All right, seeing none. So with that, House File 2505 as, I'm so sorry. That's Representative okay. Lee, go ahead, please.
Thank you. We all had a long night. Really grateful to wake up with everyone. Thanks for indulging me in my alarm this morning. And really appreciate the robust discussion here. I'm so honored to be here to present House File 2505 with Pakola and Samuel. The House has already passed legislation unanimously to make it easier to hold accountable human and labor traffickers, and including House File 2505 would be a good second step in ensuring that, you know, we provide wraparound services to support victims of trafficking. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. So with that, House File 2505 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion. And then the last bill we have for today is House File 1852, Representative Clardy. And I know you have also another bill in your packets, but that one's not going to be taken up today. So House File 1852, so I will move that House File 1852 be laid over for possible inclusion, and I don't think there's an amendment. So welcome to the committee, and go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Thank you, Chair Liebling and committee, for investing your time and attention in Minnesota's students. Let me start over. Minnesota citizens with Alzheimer's. So Alzheimer's disease is a public crisis. In 2020, 99,000 Minnesotans were living with Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia. So this number is expected to grow by 21.2% by 2025. Alzheimer's and dementia impacts everyone, and the effects are not equally felt. The Black community is twice as likely to have dementia. Latino community is 1.5 times likely to have it, and there's also elevated rates in the indigenous community as well. So people of color are more likely to have misunderstandings about dementia and the nature of aging. And part of that is that the social determinants of health and, you know, some genetic factors. So this bill is focusing on the public awareness campaign. Facing these racial disparities, the need for culturally relevant messaging on aging is more important than ever. House File 1852 appropriates $500,000 one-time funding to meet the needs to develop specially tailored public health resources and that talk about dementia and Alzheimer's. So when engaging communities of color, healthy aging, and talking about healthy aging, it's really important to make sure that the materials are also translated into different languages for the non-English speaking communities. So what House File 1852 does, it calls for the Department of Health to go out and engage with leaders in the community that they're trying to reach and develop culturally relevant materials. So while this is a one-time funding for this session, the materials will have a long-time lasting effect. And I'd like to, Chair Liebling, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier.
All right. Thank you, Representative Clardy. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm the State Affairs Manager with the Alzheimer's Association. Suspecting that last night was going to be drawn out and knowing that Edelmira Montalvo is a primary caregiver for someone with dementia, I asked for permission to read her written testimony, and that's what I'll be doing tonight. Today.
Absolutely. It feels like tonight for us. So.
And this is an English translation from her language, which is Spanish. My name is Edelmira Montalvo. I was born in Puerto Rico, and I have lived in Minnesota with my husband for 8 years. My husband was recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. If I would not have had the opportunity to learn about the early warning signs in Spanish, my husband never would have received an early diagnosis. 8 years ago, I began participating in Centro Tyrone Guzman's Wise Elders program, where I learned about Alzheimer's and even participated in an original play in Spanish to promote awareness of the 10 warning signs. Sadly, just a few years ago, I started to notice these signs with my husband. When I told his primary care doctor, she dismissed my concerns as normal memory loss caused by aging. Because of what I had learned, I knew that what my husband was experiencing was not normal. It took more than 3 years of insisting, going from doctor to doctor, and finally, just a few months ago, my husband received a formal diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. The education and resources I received at Centro Tyrone Guzman were what gave me the confidence I needed to continue fighting until he received the diagnosis, even as medical professionals doubted and minimized my concerns. Most Latinos in Minnesota have not had the opportunities that I have had, which is why so many are caring for family members with Alzheimer's without a formal diagnosis, missing out on opportunities to slow the progression and improve quality of life. More Alzheimer's education and awareness campaigns that are culturally appropriate and in Spanish are needed to increase rates of early detection and diagnosis. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone, we'll go to members and Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Clardy, for bringing this forward. I've been a supporter of this legislation and this program and continue to be. And it was great timing because just, I think it was last week, had a couple of constituents, Daryl and Mary Foss, come to visit me. And he's an advocate for Alzheimer's together with Mary. And it just one thing I wanted to comment on is the strength of the advocacy network that you have for this issue, for this need, and how important that is. And I'm just curious how you are both leveraging the network that you've developed so far and what the strategy is to reach out to leaders in other communities, because I'm just so with you that getting to the leadership of communities that are most in need of the information is essential. Thank you.
Mr. Smith?
Madam Chair, Representative Ryer, thank you for that excellent question. It's really important to note that it's not enough to simply translate materials into other languages. For example, in the Somali language, there isn't a direct translation for dementia and would come out as something along the lines of crazy. And so we can imagine how ineffective that kind of messaging would be. And that's why House File 1852 calls on the Department of Health to engage community leaders in the aging space and then collaboratively develop the kind of messaging that can effectively raise awareness around healthy aging and when it might be time to seek a cognitive assessment to determine whether it is dementia or another cognitive challenge.
Representative Ryer? Okay. Representative Becker?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So reading through this, it talks about make materials available, which I agree, education is important. If you don't know what you're doing, then you're going to definitely be lost. What specific materials will this $500,000 appropriation would be used for? Are we doing educational classes? Are we doing just pamphlets? Are we doing social media? If you could just, what's being the author, what are you, and working with the stakeholders, what's the plan?
Representative Clardy.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, Rep.
Backer. You can call me Baker. Most people do.
Thank you.
No, don't.
Just initially, what we found or what we know is that just taking standard pamphlets that they have right now and just putting it in another language is not effective without the cultural piece. So that's one of the pieces that we're looking at. And then also it's going to be, well, I'm actually going to just turn it over to my witness.
Mr. Smith.
Chair Liebling, Representative Backer, thanks for the question. I think it's important to note that there's not going to be one silver bullet that's going to be effectively engaging the different communities we're looking to connect with. For example, for underserved rural communities, radio could be a really effective way to share public health information around Alzheimer's. I know at the Alzheimer's Association, we've developed a partnership with Telemundo to share some information around Alzheimer's diagnosis, and I think that could be another really effective strategy. But the legislation itself is silent because we don't want to be predetermining the best way to reach these communities. And I think it's another area where engaging community leaders on the best messaging is going to be really important, and so I'm hesitant to make too many commitments.
Representative Backer?
Yeah, follow up. So we know we have advocacy groups out there and organizations. So what will be done so there's not duplication of services and so forth? Because obviously we want to get that message to help folks with their health. So what's your thoughts on that?
Mr. Smith.
Chair Liebling, Representative Backer, thanks for the great question. I would, at this time, I'm not worried about the state of Minnesota over-investing in outreach around Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. That work still needs to be doing and is ongoing. It's certainly a priority for organizations like the Alzheimer's Association and the Department of Health. What I would say is that this legislation is in alignment with our efforts, and we certainly don't have the resources to do all of this work right now, which is why we've come to the legislature.
No further questions. Thank you.
Representative Perryman and then Nadeau.
Very quickly, because I know we're all, our eyes I can see are kind of starting to droop. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Clardy. Thank you for being here. I really like this program because in St. Cloud is the Somali population, and they have such great values, and one of them is family. So when you are putting this all together, I would just kind of say gear it to families, because they tell me if you get to the mother, you'll get to the children, and then you get the men, and then you get the whole family. So that's how I campaigned. Anyway, I just would recommend and ask that you take that consideration, because I do, my family is has had dementia, and that's a different story, obviously, but same principle with families, that we needed to be educated more than our parents who already had it. And so I always say continue that out. And the other thing is that you have Schumacher and yourself, so what a 1-2 punch. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Clardy. It's good to see you this morning. I'm not a lover of education and outreach programs, and I only bring that up. I my mother-in-law died of Alzheimer's, and this is probably, you know, seemingly one of the worst things that you have to watch as a family member. And so I appreciate you bringing it forward. And I'm gonna build off. I've got one general question, and then I've got a specific question. I'm gonna start with the specific question first. In section 2, line point 2.21, you have a blank appropriation for the reporting requirement. Do you have any idea of what you think that might be, or who might do that? Is that gonna be University of Minnesota is gonna study it? I mean, is it gonna be the Department of Health?
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Doe, thanks for the question. That would be the Department of Health. I don't want to speak on their behalf about what the costs associated with the reporting requirement would be, but when a fiscal note is completed, I expect that you get some more information there.
Yeah. Representative Nadeau?
Thank you. And you're pretty sure it's not going to be more than $500,000, right? All right. Good. Good. Just making sure. So counties do an enormous amount of education and outreach regarding public health, regarding disease. They have these systems that are in place that actually do a lot of this work. And I'm just wondering if, and I saw in here that it was gonna, you know, with one or more third parties to develop this stuff. And we know how difficult it is to reach. You know, we do everything from bus stop advertisements to, you know, fancy videos, and they can be super expensive. And it's very difficult to measure the effectiveness of these things. And so I guess I don't have an overall question. I'm going to suggest that there might be, you know, a little more work we could do to try to work within the systems of the counties that already do so much of this. That maybe that would be helpful. But thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, we have Bierman and then Hemmingson Yeager, representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I love education programs. I think they have to be targeted, though, because if it's just advertising kind of thing, that's harder. But and I think that I want to just thank you for your work in this area, Mr. Smith, and for the bill, Rep. Clardy, because, you know, this is a growing numbers in our future that we're going to be dealing with. And I think getting the word out and kind of removing the stigma of this is really important. And so just wanted to thank you for your work in that regard. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hemmingson Yeager.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Clardy, for bringing this up. So I started learning about Alzheimer's as an undergrad, learning my genetic stuff. And, you know, we learned a lot about how there's genetic predispositions, but then there's also environmental factors. And what struck me today was when you were reading off those stats about communities of color having higher incidence rates, that tells me that we have higher environmental stressors that are acting upon these already vulnerable communities. So it's just kind of another thing where we really need to make sure we're investing in our people and making sure that we're taking into account these social determinants of health along with these environmental factors also playing a part on our genes and our physiology. So I just want to say thank you for working within the community. I think it's a really cool program, and it's a really cool idea to be getting in there, meeting people where they are so that they understand this. I kind of wish this would have been happening with my in-laws who are struggling with my grandfather-in-law. So, yeah, but thank you.
All right, thank you. Final word, Representative Clardy.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for all the feedback. And kind of going back to some of the comments that were made, the way my community does this is a lot through the mother, you know, and that's, you know, you were talking about like African culture. Well, I'm African American, so it kind of, it goes through the mother and it goes through the family and that type of thing. And as far as like the advertising piece, you're right, just a pamphlet doesn't work. There's a lot of other things, but like was said earlier, we don't want to just predetermine that. You know, there's digital forms. There's all different kinds and different models that have been done. But one thing we need to do is go back to the experts and working with the Alzheimer Association versus, you know, a broader umbrella is where the expertise is going to come from. So I really appreciate you taking your time to hear this bill today, and I know it'll make a great impact in the communities that need it the most.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much for bringing the bill today. So with that, House File 1852 is laid over for possible inclusion. So on that completes our agenda for the day. I'm sure members really want to stay here and talk some more, but we're going to...
All night. Let's do another all-nighter.
All night. Right here on forward, Representative Backer. And never let me live it down that I called you Baker, and probably will again. But with that, thank you all for being here this morning. We are adjourned.